Good evening and welcome to Indie Radio News, the weekly radio news program from The Independent, a free progressive monthly newspaper and online news site based here in New York. We cover social justice movements and the issues they are fighting for, both here in the city and around the world. We are your hosts, Elia Grahan and Lydia McMullen-Laird.
Beginning with headlines, British Prime Minister Theresa May is postponing Parliament's vote on the Brexit deal with the European Union. She's acknowledging that lawmakers would have rejected it by a significant margin. The move avoided a humiliating defeat for the government in a vote that was scheduled for tomorrow. This throws Britain's Brexit plans into disarray with the country's departure from the EU on March 29th, just over 3 months away. May's Conservative government does not have a majority in the House of Commons, and opposition parties, as well as dozens of Conservative lawmakers, say they will not back the deal. The chaos surrounding Brexit leaves both May and her government on shaky ground. Pro-Brexit lawmakers say the deal keeps Britain bound too closely to the EU, while pro-EU politicians say it erects barriers between the UK and its biggest trading partner, and leaves many details of the future relationship undecided. Meanwhile, in Egypt, authorities are quietly introducing restrictions on the sale of yellow reflective vests. They fear opponents of the government might attempt to copy French protesters during next month's anniversary of the 2011 popular uprising that toppled autocrat Hosni Mubarak. They say industrial safety equipment dealers have been instructed not to sell yellow vests to walk-in buyers and to restrict business to verified companies after securing police permission. Officials say offenders will be punished. They seem not to want anyone to do what they are doing in France, says one retailer. The police came here a few days back and told us to stop selling them. When we asked why, they said they were acting on instructions, says another. Security officials say the restrictions will remain in force until the end of January. And in climate news, an environmental group says that at least 14 foreigners have been detained or deported by Poland's border guard since last week's start of the UN climate conference. Svetlana Romanko of the group 350.org says the individuals are from Germany and other countries that are not in the EU's Schengen visa-free travel zone. Romanko accuses Polish authorities of using repressive powers and said the UN should pressure Warsaw to ensure civil society activists can take part in the meeting. Some of the foreigners were banned from entering Poland on December 8th when around 3,000 protesters marched against climate change through Katowice, where the conference is taking place. A top UN climate official is calling for efforts to achieve a constructive and inclusive atmosphere at the conference. Today, over 1,000 youth with the Sunrise Movement lobbied 50 congressional offices and sat in at the offices of Representatives Pelosi, Hoyer, and McGovern, demanding Democrats and their leaders in the House support the Select Committee for a Green New Deal before the holiday recess. In total, 143 people were arrested during the sit-ins. Joining us by phone is Sarah Blazevich, co-founder and managing director of Sunrise. She was at the action today. Hi, Sarah. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Lydia. Thanks so much for having me on.
Can you tell us a little bit about what the action was like, what the energy was like, and what you guys did today?
Yes. Yeah, so as you said, we had over 1,000 young people in Congress today, and close to 150 of them were arrested. And it was a beautiful sight to see. We had hundreds and hundreds of youth, some as young as 6 years old, many of them high schoolers, lining the halls of Congress to demand that Democrats step up and fight for our generation. We had 75 high schoolers from Kentucky who got on buses at 4 a.m. yesterday, slept in churches all over D.C. last night, and came here. We had parents with their young children. And the reason we were at Nancy Pelosi and Steny Hoyer's offices was because they're the top two Democrats in the House, and we are calling on them to reject fossil fuel donations and move the Select Committee for a Green New Deal forward before recess. So we were there to remind them that young people are demanding they step up or step aside, and I think our message was heard today.
And looking forward, what are you hoping for? What is the goal of the Sunrise Movement at this point?
So a week after the 2018 midterms, Rep-elect Ocasio-Cortez joined us in Pelosi's office, tasked Democrats to form a select committee for a Green New Deal. And less than a month later, over 25, I think, by the end of today, congressional Democrats have endorsed that select committee. Dozens more have endorsed the Green New Deal. And over 140 environmental, economic, and social justice organizations have joined our call for a Green New Deal. So over the coming months, we're going to continue pushing to build that clear public mandate for a Green New Deal, for a comprehensive plan to transform the U.S. economy off of fossil fuels in the next decade, and putting it on the national agenda. Thanks to the thousands of young people across the country who've been visiting their congresspeople's offices, we see this as a real priority for the Democrats in the coming months and in the coming years, and we intend to keep it there at the top of the priority list.
Thank you so much for that update, Sarah, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
In local news, the MTA is considering raising its fares. MTA President Andy Byford claimed the subway is losing $250 million a year from fare evasion, which supposedly justifies this fare hike. Many commuters met this news with anger and frustration. Over a dozen people rallied this afternoon in front of the Kumble Theater for the Performance Arts at Long Island University, where a public meeting is being held to get rider feedback as the MTA considers rolling out another fare hike. Michelle White, member of the Riders Alliance and part of the Fix the Subway Coalition, was present at the rally.
I live in East Flatbush, Brooklyn, and I commute to Manhattan for work every day. I take the 2 and the 5, the A and the C subway to get to work. Just last week, on my way to work during my normal transfer, I went to go to the A train, and my train was delayed on the platform for 20 minutes. By the time it crawled to Port Authority and I sat at my desk, I was 30 minutes late to work. Now, I am not a salaried employee. I am an hourly employee, and so every minute, every hour that I'm not at work, I'm not getting paid for that. So that's why I'm here today, to stand with Riders Alliance, say that I can't afford to be late for work any longer. I can't afford a fare hike to pay for service that isn't working for me. And I'm calling on Governor Andrew Cuomo to please support congestion pricing and do not fix the subway on riders' backs. Thank you.
Riders and the Fix Subway Coalition are calling on Governor Andrew Cuomo for fair funding, not fair hike. Let's connect with Michael Maskin, who's a community organizer and part of the Riders Alliance, who is present at the hearing. Hello, Michael. Can you tell us a little bit about how the hearing is going?
Sure. Thank you for having me. I actually just stepped out. Riders are upset. Riders are speaking about everything from supporting congestion pricing and other sustainable funding sources to not being able to make it to the hearing on the subway because already the fares being too high. People are really upset, but also are hopeful that the board's fast forward plan will be successful, just not on the backs of riders.
And Michael, do you think this hearing is going to be useful? Do you think they're actually going to hear out what your demands are as riders?
Well, they certainly will hear the demands. They're going to be staying here throughout. But as far as as far as actually being able to affect change, I think what we're seeing right now, sort of beyond the hearings, is this unprecedented organizing of riders, of subway, bus, and accessoride riders, who are coming together to ask for sustainable funding sources. And I think there's been a lot of press and there's been a lot of movement outside of these hearings. So I think the board is aware of the way that riders are feeling.
Great. And I assume there's going to be rallies in the next few days?
Yeah, we're planning to continue monitoring the fare hike hearing. Our big push, especially before the governor releases his budget, is to call for the inclusion of congestion pricing and other sustainable funding sources in the MTA's budget. We're saying, fair funding, no fare hike, because we're asking for other sustainable and progressive funding sources be explored before resorting to the regressive fare hike that also is not sustainable. So there will be plenty of actions, plenty of things coming up. You can check us out at ridersny.org, and also our coalition partners as well will be putting on some events.
Thank you so much, Michael.
And thanks for having me.
Our last local headline in the past hour, hundreds of members of faculty union at the CUNY City University of New York rallied outside Baruch College in Lower Manhattan. More than a dozen union leaders were arrested for blocking the doors to the campus building where the CUNY Board of Trustees is meeting this evening. The Professional Staff Congress, the union that represents 30,000 faculty and professional staffs at CUNY, has been working without a new contract for over a year. It is demanding higher pay for full and part-time staff, and that CUNY cease imposing tuition hikes on the City University's predominantly working-class immigration students. They say New York State should instead commit more public funding to CUNY. 10 members of the Board of Trustees are appointed by Governor Andrew Cuomo. 5 others are appointed by Mayor Bill de Blasio, and there is 1 student representative. For all those listeners who are just tuning in, welcome to Indie Radio News on WBAI 99.5. Today we talk about the New York Police Department's announcement on Tuesday, December 4th, that it was going to acquire 14 drones and plan to utilize them in policing efforts across the city, and has 29 officers who are trained to use these unmanned aerial vehicles, or UAVs. The objective of these new tools is to map crime scenes, monitor large events, and aid search and rescue operations. A number of groups, including ACLU, have shown their concerns about this new methodology. To talk more about the implications of the new method of monitorization, we talk to Dan Gettinger. Dan is the founder and co-director of the Center for the Study of the Drone, an interdisciplinary research and education institution at Bard College. Dan is a non-resident fellow at the Modern War Institute at West Point, an expert at the Forum on the Arms Trade, and the co-founder of the Drone Research Network. Thank you for joining us, Dan.
Thanks for having me.
As mentioned in the New York Times article that was published last Tuesday, law enforcement agencies across the country have adopted aerial drones to map crime scenes, monitor large events, and obviously aid in operations. Can you talk to us a little bit about these organizations that have already been using drones and sort of what their methodology is in implementing these drones?
Yeah, thank you. So over 900 public safety agencies across the country have acquired drones of various types. Most of these drones are the same type of drones that you can find in your local technology store. They're consumer-type drones, easily accessible and easily findable. These are not military-grade drones. These are very recognizable systems. About two-thirds of the agencies, of the 900 agencies that have acquired drones, according to our data, are law enforcement agencies, so that is state, local, police, and sheriff's departments. Most agencies that have acquired drones are in suburban or rural areas. There are not that many metropolitan areas that have acquired drones, but as we can see with the NYPD, that interest is rising among larger metropolitan police departments.
Why would you say that large metropolitan areas have not started using drones?
Well, it can be very complicated to fly drones in a crowded urban space, both from an FAA regulatory standpoint as well as from a safety standpoint. The FAA prohibits flying drones near airports without special permission, and obviously in a place like New York City, that can be complicating. It doesn't permit flying drones over crowds of people or at night, again, without special permissions. So it can be difficult to implement a drone program in a crowded urban space where you have lots of vehicles, lots of buildings, lots of impediments, as well as the regulatory limitations on using drones. And really, a lot of the interest in using drones among public safety was search and rescue to begin with. It's changed over time, but the initial interest was among a lot of more rural areas, more rural sheriffs, who wanted to use drones to be able to get, to navigate some more rural areas in their jurisdiction.
I guess one of the things that concerns most of the population or the New Yorkers is the information that is taken through the drones as captured. How can we control it, and how can we make sure that it only surveils the targeted scene that, in that case, the New York Police Department is looking for?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's certainly, drones are, like many other video technologies, video surveillance technologies, they They're in that same family. In many respects, although drones are an aerial capability, they're a new and evolving technology, they share a lot of characteristics with other types of video surveillance technologies. So I think, finding ways of better understanding the ways that drones are being used and sort of the context in which drones are being used could help, limit, potential abuses of this technology. I think, it's unusual, unusual to see drones, being used a lot in urban spaces, but also the Fire Department, NYFD, has also used drones in the past. So perhaps looking at their previous use cases and seeing how, as an example of how drones might be used in urban space, might be a good place to start.
That's a good point. And also learning from where drones are also being used, I wonder the information that's taken, how can we make sure that it's not used as unlawful surveillance? And how is the information taken by the NYPD able to be used in a court hearing or in terms of criminalizing a certain scene?
Mm. Well, I know certain states in the past couple of years have passed laws that limit the ways that the data that's collected by drones can be used, as well as the ways that drones can be used themselves. So there has been some action on the state level across the country to place some restrictions on this technology when it's used by law enforcement. In terms of how the NYPD might use drones in legal cases, I'm not so sure because it's not that common to see that so far. But certainly in the past, across the country, drones have been used to chase suspects, to locate suspects, or perhaps in more tactical situations. We could see the use of that in New York. Certainly, the type of drones that they bought, the Mavic, is a very portable system. You can imagine it being deployed, more frequently than a heavier system.
Interesting. So the chosen drones are lighter in general to be able to fly, I guess, higher up.
Well, there's a limit on how high any drone can fly, but most of the drones that the NYPD got are these smaller systems. They did get one larger system, the Matrix, also made by the Chinese company DJI, and that can carry more sophisticated sensors, heavier sensors. But the Mavic is a small drone. It's got foldable wings, so you can throw it in a backpack. So it's really designed to be ultra portable. And that has really appealed to a lot of law enforcement agencies around the country, because it's so portable, it can fit, it can be carried easily or fit easily into a patrol car.
And I guess my last question, Dan, is as citizens of New York, is there any way that one can sort of protect themselves from being surveilled by a drone?
Well, I think I think there are already limitations on that capability. The technology in itself creates limitations today. As I mentioned, these are consumer systems. They're not designed to surveil for hours at a time. They're really designed for short-term uses. So there are limitations how the technology can be used already placed by the technology and by regulations. And also the environment of New York City can make it difficult to be surveilled from a drone with all the buildings and other impediments. So I'd say there are already, plenty of limitations on the potential for drones to be used for surveillance. But certainly, as I mentioned before, this is a very dynamic technology, and it'll be important to see how the uses evolve and the technology evolves.
Well, thank you so much, Dan, for this update on the NYPD's new acquisition of 14 drones. In the second half of the program, we will be talking with Cecil
Corbin-Mark.
Stay tuned.
Demand for clean energy and affordable energy is increasing, and here in New York, the organization We Act for Environmental Justice is installing solar arrays on the rooftops of affordable housing buildings across northern Manhattan. Joining us today to talk more about the program is Cecil Corbin-Mark, the Deputy Director at We Act. Cecil, thank you for joining us.
Lydia, thank you for having me, and thank you to your listeners for listening.
So a lot of people might think of solar as something that people put on in the suburbs, on their houses, people who might be of a little bit higher income. Tell me a little bit more about your program and why you've chosen affordable housing as your focus for solar panels.
Well, our solar program is known as Solar Uptown now, and I know it's a little cold outside to be talking about sun, but that's what our program is called, Solar Uptown Now, Sun. And we focused on affordable housing because, for the very reason that you described in the opening, Lydia, many times people in the suburbs and middle-income and upper-middle-income folks, as well as the wealthy, may have some of the resources that they need at their disposal to put solar on their roofs. But we target affordable housing in northern Manhattan because they make up a significant part of the housing stock, and it is under threat. It's under threat because of the rising prices, and it's under threat because folks often don't have the ability to, as I said, put the solar panels up on their roofs with their own resources. So that's why we targeted affordable housing. It's a way of helping to reduce the cost and to provide clean, renewable energy, eliminate some of the pollution that our communities are dealing with that trigger things like asthma, et cetera, and bring people into the green new economy.
So there's been a lot of buzz nationally about the Green New Deal and everything that's happening in Washington. How might a program like yours fit into that policy space, and how might policies from the Green New Deal, if it goes through, help programs like yours?
Well, I think it's important to keep our eyes on that particular prize, but we don't need a Green New Deal just yet in order to be able to put solar panels up on the roofs of houses in communities like northern Manhattan, Harlem, and Washington Heights and Inwood. We are able to do it. We're taking advantage of some of the conditions that are right here in our own backyard before there has to be a policy passed in Washington. I think the Green New Deal is an important legislative initiative, but remember, the Democrats have only taken over the House of Representatives in Congress, and we still would have to get something through the Senate. Meanwhile, here in New York City, the mayor has said that he wants to put 100% renewable energy on the rooftops of municipal buildings, and we support him in that because we see that as an opportunity to train the workers that we train to install solar on the rooftops and to make sure that they get access to those jobs. Our program, Lydia, was really instrumental in targeting affordable housing. It's the first program in the city to take the solarized model and target affordable, multifamily affordable housing. And we think that's a way to continue to make job opportunities available for many years to come in this city. If we took the affordable housing, the HDFCs in our city, and put solar panels on the ones where the roofs are ready to take solar panels, we could be putting quite a few people to work, and that's what we want to keep doing. And then if we double that up with the mayor's commitment to make municipal buildings have renewable energy on, we can continue to drive that workforce into more good green jobs, even well before we get a Green Deal in Washington, D.C.
Thank you so much, Cecil. We'll have to leave it there for today. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Lydia.
Thank you for listening. You can catch us every Monday at 6 p.m. right here on WBAI 99.5 FM for all the latest from Indie Radio News. You can find this month's print edition of The Independent at our outdoor news boxes across the city and in local libraries, independent bookstores, and social movement centers. Follow all our latest coverage online at independent.org, that's Indie with a Y, and via social media. To let us know what you think of today's show, send news tips, or find out how to subscribe to the Independent's print edition, we can be reached at 212-904-1282 or contact at independent.org. Thank you so much to WBAI for hosting our show, and see you next week.